morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Wooderich. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Major Babu Kaza, here today with Mr. Neil Puckett on behalf of the appellant, Staff Sergeant Frank Wooderich, who is present in the courtroom today. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
For 50 years, this court has consistently held that the right to Article 38 detailed defense counsel is a fundamental right of military due process, that once entered into, an attorney-client relationship may not be severed or altered for the administrative convenience of the government. Now, in this case, you have the government refusing to take ordinary administrative action to ensure the continuity detailed defense counsel relationship, while at the same time taking extraordinary action to ensure continuity of the prosecution team. The lead military detailed defense counsel in this case was Lieutenant Colonel Colby Vokey, who was detailed to this case in January 2007. At the time that he was detailed, Lieutenant Colonel Vokey was one of the most experienced, if not the most experienced, litigator in the United States Marine Corps. In addition to his extensive litigation experience, Lieutenant Colonel Vokey is a former combat arms officer.
Counsel, let's cut to the chase here. You're asking for a writ of mandamus. The standards for a writ of mandamus, as for any prerogative writ, are very high. How do you meet those standards?
Yes, Your Honor. The standard for extraordinary writ is extraordinary circumstances. As an initial matter, Your Honor, I would note that this court has consistently, over the past 20 years, of the extraordinary writs it has granted, a large percentage of them have related directly to the right to counsel. We cite the Nguyen case in particular in our brief, and that case involved issuing a writ to allow the continuation of an attorney-client relationship. So from that perspective, the relief we're asking for is within the rubric of extraordinary writs this court has granted. Now, particularly for the facts of this case, there are extraordinary circumstances. You have a detailed defense counsel who has unique and irreplaceable knowledge of the case, an extraordinarily complex case.
What does he have that the major didn't have, that the Arabic-speaking major didn't have?
In particular, Your Honor, Lieutenant Colonel Vokey conducted a site visit with Staff Sergeant Wooderich. He walked the terrain. He observed the lines of visibility. He spoke to the Iraqi witnesses.
Were any of the data from that site visit not available to his present counsel?
Your Honor, the specific knowledge and interaction that Lieutenant Colonel Vokey had with Staff Sergeant Wooderich that would be brought to the defense team, that could not be reduced to writing or reduced to videotape. So while reports or video could certainly have been presented and have been presented to the remainder of the defense team, that unique aspect of the attorney-client relationship, that unique intangible, which this court has diligently sought to protect, cannot be replicated.
No counsel could possibly, the knowledge is such that it cannot be transferred.
Yes, Your Honor.
And have the current counsel requested to go then to repeat the site visit?
There's nothing on the record to indicate that, Your Honor. However, even if a couple of issues that, Your Honor. First, I think as a matter of public record, U.S. forces are no longer in the Al-Anbar province and President Hanifa. Second, even if they could do another site visit.
What was the point of taking the video if it was impossible to transmit to anybody else the knowledge that was obtained through the visit?
Your Honor, the video was certainly an aid to the defense team, but the primary effectiveness and the primary purpose of Lieutenant Colonel Vokey being present was to walk that terrain with Staff Sergeant Wooderich, get his input, and provide that unique legal representation through that
site. That, in your view, was your primary argument for why this might fall within that Hutchins language that says, yep. says, well,
that could not be replicated for team preparation.
Extraordinary circumstances of some sort, but that's not the exact language. But I have it here. Highly contextual circumstances that may warrant an exception.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I have a couple of fact questions. Are the following facts in or out of the record that is before us today? Does the firm that Lieutenant Colonel Vokey is at, which I think is Fitzpatrick Haygood, represent Mr. Salinas? Have they represented Mr. Salinas, and do they still do?
The evidence in the record at this point, Your Honor, is that the firm previously represented Sergeant Salinas and no longer represents him.
How is that reflected in the record? Just here, I just want, you know, page sites. What is the fact? And I'll ask the government the exact same list of questions so that we can figure out whether there's any factual dispute or whether this is purely a question of legal differences of view. Where in the record can we look to determine authoritatively?
Yes, Your Honor.
Any question? You can respond on rebuttal if you like, so that you can put your best fact forward.
Yes, Your Honor, and I will respond in more detail on rebuttal. However, at this point, at least under the base numbering that the government has provided, I would point to page 781 and page 802.
And is that reflected in writing, or is that the representations of lawyers before the court?
That is representations of lawyers before the court, Your Honor.
Next question. Does the record that is before us reflect that a waiver or consent of some sort was provided or executed by either of the individuals who were or are represented by Fitzpatrick and Hager?
The record indicates that Sasser and Woodridge has not executed any waiver, either formally or informally. The record indicates that when Lieutenant Colonel Volke first interviewed with the firm Fitzpatrick Haygood, the hiring partner orally indicated to him that Salinas was aware of it and did not have any objection to it. And the page cite for that.
And are you representing or arguing that that constitutes a waiver or consent, or are you just saying that that's the only fact that's in the record?
Just arguing that's the only fact in the record, Your Honor. It explains Lieutenant Colonel Volke's conduct, but that does not operate as a waiver.
Does the record reflect, or is it a knowable fact from some thing we're allowed to take judicial notice of, what the size of the law firm is? How many lawyers work there?
I do not believe that information is in the record, Your Honor.
Is that something that we're allowed to take judicial notice of by looking up in Martindale and Hubble if that thing is still published?
Yes, Your Honor.
What would be the basis for taking judicial notice of that?
The basis, Your Honor, that would be a public fact and found in a reference document such as Martindale Hubble and unobjected to.
On appeal, when it's not in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. This court, an appellate court can certainly look to secondary sources and has cited secondary sources such as law review articles and things of that nature.
And you're not being picked on the government in advance as being asked to respond to all the same three questions, if you don't mind when you come up. Those are my facts. Thank you.
Counsel, assuming arguendo that whatever conflict there was has dissipated, why can't he just hire Lieutenant Colonel Volke, retired, as his civilian counsel?
The initial premise of your question, Your Honor, is if the conflict is dissipated.
Yeah, arguendo.
Right. At this point, Your Honor, and getting to the reason for extraordinary relief, at this point you have a military judge stating there is an irreconcilable conflict. So absent action from this court, Sasser and Frank Woodridge could not simply hire Lieutenant Colonel Volke because there's a military judge stating there's an irreconcilable conflict.
There's an irreconcilable conflict, says the military judge. What does the state of Texas say? Where does that leave it? You're saying that because one judge said that, he can't hire him as civilian counsel.
The judge presiding over the court-martial he would be hiring for, Your Honor, has made a legal ruling that there's an irreconcilable conflict.
Therefore, irreconcilable conflict, which, in other words, he said it's not dissipated. It's not dissipatable.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well, that's not my question. My question was, assuming it can be dissipated, why didn't he just hire him as civilian counsel? Could be dissipated.
So assuming it could be dissipated.
Right. Is there any bar to his hiring him as civilian counsel?
Well, the military judge would need to reverse his ruling, and at this point he's made the...
Yes, but that's not my question. Okay. Go ahead. I think we've got your answer.
Do you have the Texas bar rules with you?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you happen to have the comment to Rule 1.09 with you?
I had the.
I'm happy to play this, do this on rebuttal as well if you want time to organize, but I can tell you what the question is and then you can come up on rebuttal and respond to it. The question is, first, Is this rule, is Lieutenant Colonel Vokey subject to this rule? If he is subject to this rule, how does the rule, and in more particular, the comment to the rule, paragraphs 4B and 5, or let's say 4A, 4B, and 5, how do those paragraphs apply or not apply, or do they apply or do they not apply to the context we are presented with? You follow?
I would hear if you could
particular language and say, here's this language, and this does not apply for the following reason, or it does apply for the following reason.
Yes, sir. And in respect, if you could reference briefly what that language is in the comments.
I'm drawing. Well, I want the language is paragraphs 4A, 4B, and 5. They're not very long. Situations where a lawyer could have acquired confidential information, that's the sort of thing that it addresses. You should look at it and decide which sentences. I don't want to load the question. It's a neutral question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Follow?
I do.
And, counsel, when you answer that question, could you advise us whether there is anything in the record, and I'm only referring to the public record, not the sealed record, which would reflect which bar he was a member of? And whether there was any reference to any particular state or federal ethical proceedings in the public proceedings of this case.
Yes, sir. I believe he did reference on the public record that he was a member of the Texas Bar.
And was there any reference to any specific rule of Texas or any federal rule regarding ethical conflicts?
In the public record, there was never any reference to a specific rule.
Thank you. Our case law recognizes that a military judge can conduct an ex parte hearing at the request of the defense to protect potentially privileged information. Article 54 requires a verbatim complete transcript, complete record of all proceedings, and the rule for court-martial 1103 requires a verbatim transcript. Has the accused in this case waived his right to a complete record of the proceedings?
No, he has not, Your Honor.
Then how can this court rely on anything that was done at the court-martial in which the judge said on the record that he was not going to have a complete proceeding or verbatim transcript of that proceeding?
Your Honor, the appellant would agree and concede that the ex parte communication was not done in accordance with the rules and is not could not properly be characterized as an ex parte hearing.
Did the defense object at the time?
There's nothing on the record to indicate objection from the defense.
Has the defense forfeited that objection?
As this is still an interlocutory matter, no, Your Honor.
Can defense counsel forfeit the accused right to a complete proceeding?
Not without the knowing and voluntary awareness of the accused, Your Honor.
RCM 804 requires the accused to be present at all court-martial proceedings, with exceptions that don't appear to apply here. The military judge stated on the record that the accused was not present at the ex parte proceeding. Has the defense waived the right of the accused to be present at that proceeding?
No, Your Honor.
Has defense counsel's failure to object forfeited that right?
No, Your Honor.
Then how can this court rely on anything that took place during that ex parte proceeding?
At least under the rules, this court could not consider that an ex parte proceeding under the UCMJ.
Sure, should we strike all portions of the defense counsel's brief that refer to what did or did not take place at the sealed proceeding?
Possibly the best way to analyze that, Your Honor, would be to consider this an ex parte 802 conference.
Outside ex parte 802 conference? What authority is there under 802 to have a proceeding in which there is the accused is excluded and a major issue in the case is litigated with representations by counsel?
There is nothing in UCMJ.
Thank you. Now, the defense brief at 3 says that the military judge erred by concluding that Vokey has an irrevocable conflict. And the defense brief insists that it's only an imputed conflict. If we can't rely on anything that took place in that ex parte proceeding, how do we know?
Your Honor, from the public record, you have the statements from Lieutenant Colonel Vokey's representations to the court that the firm had previously represented Sergeant Salinas. You have public statements on the record that there was not any confidential communication passed between Lieutenant Colonel Vokey and the rest of the firm. Based on that, this court can conclude there was no actual conflict.
At what point in the record did the defense counsel say that there's only an imputed conflict and there's no actual conflict?
In the public record, the defense counsel didn't say
that. In fact, didn't defense counsel on the record say exactly the opposite? Didn't they assure the judge that there was something here more than the representation of counsel by another firm, the client by another firm? Didn't they say there was more than that going on in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, but that's not inconsistent with imputed disqualification.
Oh, so the judge is required then to question counsel as if counsel was a hostile witness on cross-examination?
No, Your Honor, with the defense
Why
counsel...
Why couldn't the judge rely on that representation by counsel?
Certainly the judge could. When the defense counsel said there was more to the disqualification, that didn't indicate it was not imputed disqualification. It was simply indicating that it was more than simply the law firm that previously represented this person who happened to be a witness, that there was going to be some facts as they were developed on the record that would make them more materially adverse.
So they did not assure the judge that it was only an imputed qualification on the record?
They're explaining that the, again, that the imputed the nature of the imputed disqualification wasn't simply this firm at one point represented this person who may have a tangential role in the case. I think what they're clarifying was that this person may have a more than tangential role in the case.
Your brief,
it was still an imputed disqualification, Your Honor.
Your brief states that the conflict will be reconciled simply by recalling Lieutenant Colonel Vokey to active duty if the government requiring the United States to exercise its authority would be consistent with this court's precedent. So you're asking us to take steps that would result in the ordering of Lieutenant Colonel Vokey back to active duty. Is that what you've asked for in the brief?
That's an option discussed in the brief.
Okay. Well, in terms of that option, where in the record did the defense ask the military judge to take a step that would result in the government being in a position to order Colonel Vokey to active duty?
In the August 2010 Article 39A sessions, when this issue was first litigated, there was discussion of recall to active duty.
I know there's discussion when we're talking about the particular motions that are before the court on September 13th and 14th. Where did the defense make a motion for the judge to undertake action that would result in Lieutenant Colonel Volke's recall to active duty?
There wasn't a specific motion, Your Honor.
So if there wasn't a motion, we're here on extraordinary writ. Why shouldn't we just return the case to the military judge and let the military judge consider whatever the defense now wants the military judge to do?
Well, the relief the defense is asking for, Your Honor, is declaratory judgment that the appellant's right to Lieutenant Colonel Vokey is violated and then remand to the military.
What case stands for the proposition that this court can issue a declaratory judgment under the All Writs Act?
Certainly just argue that declaratory judgment is within the realm of extraordinary relief, Your Honor.
What case in the Article III system stands for the proposition that the All Writs Act provides authority to issue a declaratory judgment?
I don't have that off the top of my head, Your Honor. I can certainly provide that as supplemental authority.
It's not a request.
Counsel, if I could ask on just a couple of factual questions. Are you done, Chief Judge Efron? Without going into detail, when you appear before the military judge with respect to the disqualification of Lieutenant Colonel Vokey, was it the defense's position at that point in time that he was or was not disqualified?
When he was appearing during the pendency of the litigation, Your Honor? During the actual motion itself?
Yes. At that point in time, the defense's position was that he was disqualified, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Have
you gone back to the military judge since that point in time and explained to him or her, whoever it would be at this point in time, that you believe that he now is not disqualified?
Well, Your Honor, as long as Lieutenant Colonel Vokey works at Fitzpatrick Haygood, he is disqualified.
That's not my question. Have you gone back to the military judge and made the same argument to the military judge that you bypassed the military judge in favor of the CCA in this court for?
specifically that Lieutenant Colonel Boki should be recalled in order to defeat the imputed disqualification?
Specifically that the only disqualification is an imputed disqualification, and then the further argument, which whether it's right or wrong, I don't know at this point in time, but then your further argument that if the that if he's recalled to active duty, that the imputed disqualification would dissipate. Have you made those arguments to the military judge, upon which you would need to convince him in order to, as the predicate for your next request, which is ask the government to recall him to active duty?
Not specifically, Your Honor.
Why not?
The basis for the extraordinary relief, Your Honor, is when Lieutenant Colonel Boki attempted to stay in active duty, he was told by Manpower he wasn't able to. So,
but that was eons ago, and a lot's happened since then.
Certainly, that can be argued, Your Honor. However, at least as presented to the defense and as presented by Manpower, Lieutenant Colonel Boki could not continue in active duty, so that's not an option the defense is able to exercise. They're only left with Lieutenant Colonel Boki working at Fitzpatrick Haygood, where he's disqualified.
But you are where you are today, which is Lieutenant Colonel Boki has worked where he worked, and the military judge made his ruling based on the defense's position on that particular day. And now you're coming and asking us to have Lieutenant Colonel Boki return to active duty as though the military judge did something other than exactly what you asked him to do.
The military judge did consider recalled active duty, Your Honor, and he specifically and incorrectly found that recalled active duty would not solve the disqualification, which was erroneous. So the military judge did consider recalled active duty.
Well, on what page did he rule that against any request from the defense regarding recalled active duty?
I would again simply point to his findings of fact, conclusions of law, where he discusses possible remedies, and he discusses recalled active duty by Lieutenant Colonel Boki to active duty, and indicates that the disqualification, erroneously indicates that disqualification would travel with Lieutenant Colonel Boki and it would not resolve the issue.
Was that not the defense's position to the military judge in the closed session, which we can take notice of or not take notice of without getting into details of it? You can't go and argue one thing to the military judge and come in here and argue the exact opposite as though he did something wrong based on what you told him.
Sure.
I mean, you can, but it's not very persuasive.
I would disagree that there are opposite positions at trial and at the appeal level, Your Honor. The trial defense team presented the issue to the military judge accurately as to what the nature of the disqualification was. There was discussion of recall of active duty in the August Article 39A session. Mr. Farage specifically discussed that. The military judge, in issuing his ruling, took all this into consideration and discussed the recall of active duty. Therefore, for the appellant now to come to this court and discuss recall to active duty is consistent with that.
Counsel, on page 29 of the September 14th record, when there was a specific discussion of remedy, the defense only asked for two remedies: dismissal with prejudice and dismissal without prejudice. And then defense counsel said expressly, "We don't have a solution. I can't institute a remedy to fix what's taken place. The government may be able to and have the resources to. It may take some mental gymnastics to figure it out, but it's going to have to be solved." At no point when they had the opportunity there did they ask for the military judge to take steps to order or arrange for the order for a return to active duty. So the question is, why shouldn't we return the case to the military judge and allow him to consider that at this point? If we have the power to issue that order, doesn't the military judge?
The military judge has already found that recall to active duty would not solve ethical conflict. So simply asking the military judge to consider recall when the military judge has found that there would still be ethical conflict would not accomplish restoring the attorney-client relationship.
Have any circumstances changed since the hearing before the military judge in regard to the representation of this individual by the law firm? Are they exactly the same now as they were then?
Yes, Your Honor. So simply...
But you did not make the argument to the military judge that return to active duty would dissipate the imputed conflict at either a closed or an open session.
There's nothing in the record indicating it was in those words, Your Honor, although what we have now, though, is still the finding by the military judge that recall to active duty would not solve the ethical conflict. So simply returning to the military judge to discuss something he's already indicated would not solve the conflict would not restore the attorney-client relationship. In order for that to happen, it's necessary for the military judge's ruling that there is an irreconcilable conflict to be held legally erroneous. Once that is done, again, that's exactly what the appellant is asking for in this case, which is declaratory judgment that the attorney-client relationship was improperly severed and that the military judge erred.
And it's your view that the military judge didn't base that finding upon representations by counsel?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
It's your view that the military judge didn't make that finding based on representations of defense counsel?
He did make that finding based on representations.
Thank you. That's all I have.
I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor.
You'll have further opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Brian Keller, and along with Colonel Louis Puglio, I represent the government. I'd like to answer Judge Baker's questions up front. I think you asked for page cites, and some of them I agree with the defense on. 780 and 803, I think he said 781 and 802. I think that's exactly where the conflict at the time of hiring discussion happens on the record with the bait stamp version. Regarding no waiver by appellant, I think that's 779 to 784, where the defense team says we are not going to allow the judge to elicit any kind of waiver, discuss any kind of waiver with the appellant because he's just not going to waive this. And then I believe in as to whether at some point, I don't have the cite for you in this, I tried to find it, Your Honor. Mr. Bokey says he believes that Mr. Hagan told him that Sergeant Salinas waived, but he says he's not sure, is what I recall, and that's in the Mr. Bokey testimony section. Appellant also mentioned the Nguyen case. The difference between this and those sort of cases is that the Nguyen case, that's a gross abuse of discretion. That's contrary to the Andrews case, I think it's 21 CMA 165, where this court affirmed that it was there's no post-government employment bar to being a defense counsel on active duty and then going out being a civilian and continuing to represent the person on active duty, or well, the person who's your defendant when you're on active duty. So that's a gross abuse of discretion. This is not a gross abuse of discretion. The government would like to talk about make three points. This becomes very confusing because it's hard to tell whether we're talking about Mr. Bokey or we're talking about Lieutenant Colonel Bokey. And in the same token, we're talking about the Sixth Amendment right, and we're talking about Article 27 and 38 right. But this can be made clear, I think, for three reasons. One, because this is invited error. Because appellant said, you can't talk to appellant, he's not going to waive this. There's a conflict here, we're not going to do anything about it.
Well, counsel, why don't we start three steps early? I mean, you want to start where we're at now, which I suggested to appellants, to defense counsel's counsel, that, you know, we are where we are now, but now you're the government. Why don't I ask you, whose fault is it that we are where we are now?
It's appellant's fault where we're at right now, Your Honor. I think that, again, it's got to be divided up into two. I was going to talk first about the...
Let's talk about Lieutenant Colonel Bokey,
yes,
and whose fault that was.
Right. And that's the first of the two different issues. First, you've got the Lieutenant Colonel Bokey issue, which is the Hutchins issue, and Hutchins resolves that 100%. That's exactly the Hutchins analysis. And second, you've got the...
Well, no, it's a little bit different than Hutchins, because in Hutchins, we didn't have Hutchins saying that he wanted to keep his particular attorney. We didn't have the attorney showing any particular interest in continuing on active duty to represent Hutchins. That's exactly the different case than what we have here.
This is pre-trial, too, is it not? And Hutchins was post-trial, was it not?
Yes, right. So they're okay. It's not exactly Hutchins. It's,
it's like exactly the opposite.
Isn't Hutchins 100% that the government erred? And then the whole question there was what impact it had on the trial. Since you haven't had a trial now, why is the government not interested in correcting the error before the trial? Or is it the government's position that what you'd like to do is have us deny the writ, and then have this counsel issue latent in the case, throughout the case, encumbered now by two additional issues, that the counsel issue was decided in a proceeding that was not the result of a verbatim record, and the counsel issue was decided without the accused being present. So I guess it's the government's view that you'd like to have those two issues embedded in the trial, so in the event that you get a conviction, you have no chance to argue on appeal whether those are prejudicial or not.
Well, I'm not correcting Your Honor, but the Hutchins was not about the Government error, but it was about the judge's error.
I understand.
And that's exactly what we have here. We've got an 813 error, which is, and again, separating it out until you've got the Lieutenant Colonel Boki issue, and once that's severed by retirement, because appellant said, and what he asked for, he said that there's a severance event. He said that when Lieutenant Colonel Boki retired, that was a severance event. So in that way, it's like Hutchins. And yes, there are differences between this and Hutchins, but what Hutchins does tell us is that the analysis before that the lower court relied on, which is the Iverson, the Eason analysis, which says that there's some kind of endemic prejudice analysis that goes into that good cause analysis, that's not the case. You can subject this to a prejudice analysis when the detail counsel has changed, because you don't have the right to that meaningful relationship. That's the Morris v. Slappy issue, and it's similar in that ways. Now, this court didn't resolve in Hutchins all those cases, Iverson, Eason, et cetera, but what you do have is you have a Hutchins issue insofar as you've got, first of all, in this Hutchins, the Hutchins analysis in this court, the court talked about four factors why it's not structural or Sixth Amendment, and that is, one, because you've got multiple counsel, and that's exactly what we've got here. We've got replacement detail counsel. We've got Lieutenant Colonel Tafoya, and then a large team that has grown and has accompanied appellant through this process, through this whole multi-month, multi-year process. Two, you've got continuity of the same counsel over that retirement event, which appellant says is a severance. Lieutenant Colonel Tafoya details himself. You've got, I believe, Mr. Zaid, and you've got Mr. Puckett that continue over that retirement event that puts on a new detail counsel. Three, I believe, is, apologies, Your Honor. You've got the multiple continuances that were granted. You've got the judge saying here, then and still, that he will grant additional continuances so that the defense can prepare. They can ask for additional trips, et cetera.
Counsel, I guess the bottom line is this. While agreeing with you that it's not a structural error issue, what are we to make of a situation where there's an individual who has detailed counsel, who's the only one that's made the site visit to Iraq, who claims to have spent lots of time speaking with the accused and with the accused family, that the accused says he wants the person to continue to represent him, that the counsel indicates that he's willing to stay on active duty and represent him, and at the same time, the government keeps other people on active duty past their time, and yet they let the other person go. So that's the genesis of the problem. What are we to make of that? Why isn't that prejudicial, starting at that point in time, leaving everything that's happened since then aside?
Well, I think, first, again, the appellant has to... Yes, there's some prejudice there. The question is whether it's 59A prejudice, but the preliminary question is whether appellant has demonstrated that there's a gross abuse of discretion, that he's got an indisputable right to relief for that good cause retirement of Lieutenant Colonel Bogues. He says that's a severance event when he retired and when he was replaced by another detailed defense counsel. He's got detailed defense counsel, and he's got, unless he's going to allege IAC, or he's going to say that the government has actually actively interfered with him staying on active duty. I mean, he says that the government prevented him from staying on active duty, but he says that manpower did that. And here, unlike Hutchins, we've got Lieutenant Colonel Yetter's testimony saying that there are strategic manpower concerns that are going through the number of active duty officers that can actually be in the Marine Corps at any one point in time. And you've got the appellate exhibits where Colonel Boki asked to stay on active duty twice, and it said that there were no significant effects in the Marine Corps. But what that shows, first of all, it shows invited error because he never asked again to stay on active duty. He didn't ask a fifth time. And second of all, it shows that again, manpower.
Why is that invited error? When a government official who has responsibility for undertaking a task repeatedly tells a subordinate or a person who would be subject to that person's direction or decision, don't ask me again. Why do we get to invited error then at that point? It may be that some consideration gets played as to the question of whether this should or should not have been brought to the attention of the judge. But why is that invited error at that point?
First, it shows that there's no gross abuse of discretion in the judge's findings.
That's not my question. My question is, why is it invited? You've invoked the doctrine of invited error several times here now. How did the defense invite the error by listening to officials in the Marine Corps as to the potential for remaining on active duty?
Well, the, he didn't. He asked a third time, and he was told by the deputy director that he couldn't, but then he asked a fourth time, and he was granted. And he never asked a fifth time. So clearly he knew he could ask again. That was the deputy director.
Isn't what we've got here a bureaucratic concern for end strength, statutory end strength in the Marine Corps?
Yes, sir.
And end strength within competitive categories and grades, basically shoving the right to counsel aside.
Well, no, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that
it's
the good cause that shows that the counsel can't return in a reasonable time. You have the there's no doubt that you've got the 8-13 error here, because on the record is not technically exactly everything you need. But again, unlike Hutchins, you've got on the record Colonel Yetter's testimony, you've got the appellate exhibits to talk about this manpower concern, and you've got defense again not asking to stay on active duty, Mr. Vokey. The difference is between this and Hutchins that you can go through that 59 analysis. Not only does he not demonstrate the indisputable right to relief, but you can go through that analysis. Mr. Puckett, record of trial at 807, said again, I think it was pointed out before, that the defense had already secured the reports and things like that from the trip to Iraq. The videographer was still on the team. The military judge said the videographer could still lay the foundation for the introduction of the videotapes. Mr. Farage is on the team. He speaks fluent Arabic. He's been, as the military judge says, the most active member of the defense team for this two-year period during which the 62s were going on. There's been other litigation.
What is the government's view as to the correct manner in which a Sixth Amendment severance claim should be addressed or adjudicated? If there's a textbook way, clearly colonels at Manpower are not experts on Sixth Amendment rights, and even Marine second lieutenants know that that's probably not where you're going to go to have a Sixth Amendment opinion issued. Where should you go? What is in the government's view, what is the textbook way in which a Colonel Vokey in the future should go about the business of addressing a Sixth Amendment severance issue?
Well, clearly through the courts, Your Honor. The defense has to establish, if they don't get it done in the courts, and they're going to ask for an appellate court to review the question and to resolve it, they've got to demonstrate the indisputable right to relief, either by showing, I think as this court again pointed out in Hutchins, that there's been some kind of interference with the attorney-client relationship purposely to try to keep him out of the defense team, or any of the other factors I believe that were talked about. There's got to be an IACO allegation, or there's got to be some kind of actual denial of a request to continue. And again, that didn't happen here. He's got to ask somehow to stay on, and he's got to get a denial. But we don't have it here. We've got granted.
You have to have an actual denial as opposed to don't ask me again.
Well, I think the judge was not did not abuse his discretion grossly in finding that was not a denial. He should have asked again.
Counsel,
well, that's a different question.
So to the extent this was adjudicated, it was adjudicated, and I use that in quotes, it was adjudicated in some manner at Manpower by a Colonel Redmond, and then the next time it was adjudicated in the September 39A session. Is that a correct statement? I'm not pushing one way or the other.
Well, no, it simply wasn't, because he didn't ask to extend. He never asked
to the extent it was adjudicated, those would be the options. And
I think
it meant adjudicated in quotes.
Well, and the judge here, obviously, looked on the record and heard testimony and made findings that he never put in a fifth extension request. So it was, again, that's an invited error.
And so you keep on talking about the indisputable right to relief, and I understand that this is here on a writ of mandamus, but the government does understand Chief Judge Efron's point, correct, that you could win this particular battle and nonetheless lose the war over an issue like this in the long run. I'm not saying that you would, but I would be surprised, or I would hope that the government wouldn't disagree that there's at least an appearance of unfairness here back with Lieutenant Colonel Vokey, given what the government did with respect to government counsel who were similarly situated.
Well, I think that issue was, I think the defense said they were going to bring an unlawful command influence motion regarding this, and they never did on the issue of...
Is it too late?
It's not too late. Of course they can, Your Honor.
Well, litigation could still take place in this case, can it?
Yes, Your Honor. I assume it's going to go back to trial. I think right now trial is scheduled for the summer. So the first issue is not 100%, but it's close to being a Hutchins issue. The second issue, then, is purely the conflict of interest issue. And this court in Beckley in 2001 resolved the Texas, or heard the Texas, I think, Rule 1.05 issue, and said that when you don't have waivers by both sides, and you've got a conflict of interest, there's no abuse of discretion, I believe it was, to say that there's a disqualification of the counsel of choice. And again, there's no Sixth Amendment right to conflicted counsel. The concern under Reed is the adversarial process, not inexorably the any right to counsel that you might want.
Does the government agree that but for Lieutenant Colonel Vokey's release from active duty, that the conflict of interest would not have arisen?
I think that's probably true. We don't know whether he would have worked at that firm or not. He had to get off active duty before he got a job at that.
Does the government have a view as to whether there would be a conflict of interest if he were to return to active duty?
No, I think that the defense sites...
No, you don't have a view or there it would be none.
I'm sorry to make this more complicated than I should. I think that there's probably still a conflict. The defense sites, but it hasn't been litigated, and that's the whole problem here. I mean, he hasn't either quit the firm, he hasn't asked to come back on active duty, none of this. So he wants, basically, he's got a situation, he's trying to have his cake and eat it too, and have this court solve the problem for him. We don't know. Pro-education talks about, as he cites...
Is it fair to say that it is the government's view, then, that it is an open question as to whether the various ethics rules that may apply would permit or not permit Lieutenant Colonel Vokey to return to active duty?
There is, I think it's an open question, but I think there's also ethic rules that say, in Texas in particular, that say that confidential materials includes just sitting in partners' meetings. And again, we don't know, because we don't know what's inside the sealed exhibit, and we haven't asked to see what's inside the sealed exhibit, so that may be more damning or say that there's
no actual... Do we know whether the Texas authorities would waive any conflict?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Do we know whether the Texas authorities would waive any conflict if asked?
I still
do we know if the Texas authorities would waive any conflict if asked?
Whether the Texas authorities
are. Right. In fact, doesn't the military judge's findings on page 14 say what his licensing authority has to say about this has not been demonstrated in court?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there's case law in the Fifth Circuit that supports that you've got to have written waivers. They've looked at both the Texas rules and the ABA rules, and of course he's still a civilian, Mr. Vokey, so we're dealing with the Texas rules here. You've got to have written waivers of both parties. And again, I don't have the page site that says that we've only got a representation. There might be an oral waiver of Sergeant Salinas, but we don't have a written waiver of Mr. Vokey.
Can the judge advocate general waive any conflict in this case? That is, are we talking, is the military judge in this case bound by Texas rules, or is he bound by the rules of the Judge Advocate General of the Navy?
Well, I believe he's bound by both of them, Your Honor. I mean, he's a civilian and he's practicing in Texas. But again, the Judge Advocate
what
General...
What case stands for the proposition that state laws trump federal laws with respect to who can represent a defendant in a federal proceeding?
I don't have that for you, but it's not the ethical, clearly it's not the ethical rules alone that concern us. We're looking at whether there's going to be a serious potential for conflict, and that's why the courts like the Supreme Court are looking at the ethical rules in Texas and they're looking at the ABA rules. I don't have that side for you.
And in this case, it appears that the government is relying upon a decision by the military judge based upon a proceeding of which the government is not aware of the context, which took place without a verbatim record and without the presence of the accused. Is that what the government's relying on in this case, or do you have any other theories as to why the writ should be denied?
We're not relying on that because we don't know what's in there. I think what I said was...
Are you relying on the validity of... Are you asserting the validity of a proceeding in which there's no verbatim record and the accused was not present?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. We've got appellants saying... We've got Mr. Puckett getting on the stand, or Mr. Puckett standing up and saying, we want you to... We have Mr. Vokey saying, I've got a conflict of interest, I need to get off this case. And the tactical decisions of the defense team can be imputed to appellant for the purposes of invited error, and I can give you cites for that if you like. And second of all, you've got Mr. Puckett saying, I'd like you to rule on this conflict issue, and we find, I believe that it's more than a mere appearance, and it's a real conflict of interest. What more do you need for the judge to then believe we've got a conflict of interest here?
I don't know. It might be, what more do we need? Might be good to have a proceeding on the record with the accused present in which there is actual discussion of the particular rules and issues at stake.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and the trial is still proceeding. And so I'm taken together. The facts here simply do not demonstrate this is an X-ray case. First of all, and understanding that there could be problems if some of these issues are not resolved, including the ex parte hearing issue, but Hutchins, Gonzalez-Lopez, this can be resolved on direct review. There's nothing about this from being resolved on direct review. Number two, Mr. Vokey, he possibly could be brought back to active duty. We don't know because he's never asked. Number three, appellant can ask for him to be IMC'd, but the problem with being IMC'd is that the JAG's rules for IMC'ing in the Navy say that if you're a retiree, that's good cause, I believe, to sever the attorney-client relationship.
To take your second point, then, just to be clear, the government is not asserting at this point that it will oppose the restoration of Lieutenant Colonel Vokey retired to active duty.
The government's not taking a position on that right now. I believe that USERRA says, which was cited by the defense, but I think that the facts point the other direction, that there probably still is a problem. The appellant cites USERRA, and I see my time is about to expire. May I continue on?
You may continue. The question is, does the government oppose the return of Lieutenant Colonel Vokey to active duty?
The government is not taking possession of that. I believe that USERRA might continue to create a problem for him, because if there's not a severance of association, then there's still a conflict of interest.
Well, assuming for the sake of argument that that the appellant doesn't meet the standards for an extraordinary writ, and assuming for the sake of the argument that they go back to the military judge and request that he revisit the conflict issue when the conflict issue is resolved, at that point in time, would the government support Lieutenant Colonel Vokey's return to active duty?
If the conflict issue is resolved, if the manpower,
I think you agreed with Judge Baker that manpower really isn't the correct person to be adjudicating that issue.
No, Your Honor, because he's got no right. Appellant has no right to Mr. Vokey as detailed defense counsel after the severance event, and that is pursuant to Hutchins. After he is off active duty, he's got no right to that. I'm not saying that he couldn't be brought back to active duty.
But it sounds like the government's position is going to be that they are opposed to being returned to active duty. Is that
my
correct?
My understanding is you're saying the government is not taking a position now, however hard we try. And secondly, you were distinguishing between the military judge determining there's a Sixth Amendment right in play versus a mere request. Is that fair to say?
I think you're saying what I said, which is that
in theory, this is supposed to make it more clearer what your position is.
I'm sorry. This is what the government's position is. First of all, the retirement event. Appellant comes here and he wants you to solve the problem for him that Mr. Vokey himself created. Number one, the retirement event is resolved by Hutchins. Once he is off active duty, he has no right to Lieutenant Colonel Vokey as a detailed defense counsel anymore. Mr. Vokey, number two, when Mr. Vokey then reassociated himself with the defense team, it becomes a counsel of choice issue. Now, if there's a denial of counsel of choice, that's pretty problematic. But the Sixth Amendment under Wheat bows to the concern for a conflict-free counsel. So instead of resolving that or trying to resolve that, appellant has thrown up his arms and said, please, appellate courts, resolve this for me. I know that Your Honors are asking the government to take positions on something, you're asking us if we have a position on something, but it's hard to say if we have a position on that when appellant hasn't litigated any of this. We don't know what the pro-education resolves.
Trial counsel made it very clear that he had not been approached for a request to ameliorate the conflict. Is it the position of the government that trial counsel will be open for business and will be willing to consider requests from the defense to ameliorate the situation, including a request from the defense to restore Colonel Vokey to active duty?
If he's not the right person, Your Honor. It's manpower. If he wants to come back to active duty, he has to go to manpower. And so the government's position is that it is manpower that does this. They have
it's
to
manpower
look at the strategic...
because it's your view that there's no Sixth Amendment right to Colonel Vokey's representation.
There's no right to him as detail counsel.
And if there was a legal right to it, then it'd be a judge's jurisdiction. But you're saying, as the government sees it, this is just a manpower issue, because unless there's a right, a legal right to something, it's a reserve affairs issue.
If there's a, I think what needs to happen is if he wants to, if the second severance event, the disqualification event was erroneous, and if he needs to, or rather, if there's a way to solve that by bringing him back to active duty, I think what needs to happen is some, if that was erroneous, assuming it was erroneous, then there has to be some close coordination to get him back on active duty. I mean, it's ultimately a manpower decision, and they could cause a later problem, there's no doubt. But that whether to bring him back to active duty, whether there are greater military strategic concerns that meet that good cause 505F definition, number one, and number two, meet the Article 27 requirement that the Secretary lay out the grounds for detailing counsel. And that includes, I believe, the IMC request, which is, you know, whether there's actually, whether they're reasonably available, I think, is the language. So those two have to work together.
One more time on that. If the court, and I'm not saying we will, but if the court denies the writ, is there anything that would preclude the defense from going to the military judge and saying, we request specifically that you abate the proceedings until Lieutenant Colonel Vokey is ordered to active duty? And then that would be a motion that would be litigated at the trial level.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, that completes the government's argument. We request that you affirm the lower court's denial of the X-ray.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
And counsel, I cut you off a bit quickly at the end there, so because I thought you were finished. But if you had further responses, I'll give you an opportunity now to any of the questions that I had been asking at that time.
Yes, Your Honor. Initially, I would disagree with some of the government's factual characterizations. They discussed Lieutenant Colonel Vokey not asking for additional retirement. So he asked for a fifth time, or he didn't ask for a fifth time. He got everything he asked for. It's simply not supported by the record. What the record indicates is that Lieutenant Colonel Vokey spoke to Manpower in July of 2008, said he wanted to stay on the case through completion. They told him no. He was going to be gone in August. Subsequent to that, Lieutenant Colonel Vokey indicated he just needed additional time for terminal leave and proceed, not to represent Staff Sergeant Woodridge. Manpower gave him additional time solely for terminal leave and proceed, not to continue representing Staff Sergeant Woodridge.
Let's focus on the military judge. Judge Baker, go ahead. You had a question.
Just to be clear, does the defense agree with the government that it's not up to a colonel in Manpower to adjudicate Sixth Amendment claims and assertions?
Yes, Your Honor, although the government certainly is responsible for the actions that its agents take. And certainly I would...
What is the correct form if you're writing the textbook? What is the manner in which a defense counsel who's going to be EAS'd feels there's a Sixth Amendment issue? Where should they adjudicate such a claim?
So the textbook answer, Your Honor, would certainly be the military judge. Once that court-martial convenes, the military judge is responsible for ensuring the due process rights of the military service member. Now, in this case, I would specifically note that repeatedly, in almost every 39A session from arraignment onwards, the defense counsel indicated that there was a retirement event in April of 2008 and they opposed continuances.
And that wasn't a trick question. I just really wanted to make sure there's no difference of view on that, that somehow this room full of lawyers thought Manpower was actually in charge of the Sixth Amendment. And there appears to be no disagreement on that point.
Correct, Your Honor. The only proper severance authority once a court-martial has commenced would be the military judge under either RCM 505 or 506. Now, at the time that the severance event happened, the case had been removed from the military judge through an Article 62 appeal. Lieutenant Colonel Vokey did everything possible, as indicated on the record. The Chief Defense Counsel of the Marine Corps was aware of this issue. His chain of command was aware of the issue. He specifically noted in his request he needed to stay on active duty to represent Staff Sergeant Woodridge for the Haditha court-martial. Certainly the government, again, while Manpower may not be the adjudicative body, they were put on notice that there's a legal issue, and they still bear responsibility for that severance event. And again, the government was put on notice.
I understand, Your Honor.
Yes,
fair enough. Don't use your time up on that, though.
That answered the questions I had. Thank you.
Counsel, ultimately, where's the prejudice here? He may not have Vokey. Let's leave aside of the question of whether it was severed, when, or if ever. But he doesn't have Vokey right now. He has a whole stable of lawyers. He has civilian attorneys. He has detailed defense counsel. He has access to all the work product that Vokey prepared, and he's had years to prepare. Where's the prejudice?
Your Honor, if I may answer the question. Yeah, accepting the premise of your argument that there will be a prejudice analysis at this point.
There wasn't Hutchins. Go ahead.
Well, during an interlocutory matter.
Yeah, go ahead.
The prejudice is he's not going to have the one attorney that was present in Iraq and conducted the site visit and spoke to the Iraqi witnesses.
So it all turns on the site visit.
That's an essential piece of it, Your Honor. While the prosecution team has prosecutors that made that site visit, simply asking for, ultimately the appellant is asking for, is for the same consideration the government has received throughout this case, which is that they had, that the appellant has continuity of his experience, specifically and uniquely experienced defense counsel.
Well, that's not really my question. I mean, it may be nice to say he should have the same thing, but I'm not asking that. I'm asking where the prejudice is.
Sure. So, yes, the site visit, and understanding the premise of your argument that given enough time, certainly lawyers could get experience. However, the record indicates that Lieutenant Colonel Vokey, for the 18 months prior to his improper severance, worked solely on Sassard Woodridge's case, attended specific CLE conferences for this case. A large portion of this case is going to turn on analysis of photographs, blood spatter, things such as that. Lieutenant Colonel Vokey, just spending hundreds of hours on this case, attended those CLE conferences. So again, we have a trial approaching this summer, potentially, and there's simply no way to replicate that. And even putting aside that, and understanding that you may disagree with that, again, the Iraq site visit is unique and absolutely essential for a case such as this, particularly when the prosecution has that benefit.
Let's stipulate that's all correct. How do you leave the Marine Corps if you're a defense counsel and you've done a site visit then? And the Sixth Amendment right attaches. But let's say there is something that's so indispensable, your EAS comes up, and can you not leave?
I think
you being the defense counsel.
Yes, sir. What this court indicated in Hutchins, and I would strenuously disagree with the government's argument that a manpower event can unilaterally sever, and military justice system has no oversight over that. Under Hutchins, this court indicated that there's a series of factors which need to be taken into consideration. The impact.
Take your factors. There's an indispensable site visit in the Sixth Amendment right. The continuity of that counsel attaches. So that just means that defense counsel who joined the Marine Corps for X amount of time is now a lifer.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's what Hutchins stands for.
I know. Hutchins' case doesn't describe what I just described.
You would not. I would agree with you, Your Honor. You would not be a lifer. However,
and how do you leave the Marine Corps in that context?
You would have to approach the military judge and lay out whatever the good cause factors are that are requiring you to be severed. The military judge could conduct a Hutchins analysis and determine
if the good cause is your EAS has come up and you promised your family that you would serve 20 years rather than an indefinite amount of time. But I understand your argument, the extension of your argument to be, well, if you did the site visit or the indispensable act that creates the Sixth Amendment bond, you can't leave. You can't have good cause then. EAS is not good cause. Or is it good cause if the person, the counsel, wishes it to be?
No, EAS can't be good cause, objectively. Certainly there can be good cause, but when you've got, again, the Sixth Amendment talks about the right to have counsel investigate the charges, and uniquely, in this circumstance, an Iraq site visit is a unique investigation under the Sixth Amendment. Now, say the counsel was disabled or something like that.
Let me try it a different way. If Lieutenant Colonel Vokey, at the time of his EAS, instead of requesting speaking to some colonel in manpower, and gone to the court and said, my EAS is up, I'd like to withdraw from the case. Is it the defense's position that he could not have done so in light of the fact that he conducted the indispensable site visit?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the defense's position there would not be good cause for severance at that point, and the military judge taking into account.
Then at what point could that Lieutenant Colonel Vokey ever leave the Marine Corps? Not until the trial was resolved.
Correct, Your Honor. And in this case, it's unique because there's so much, so many interlocutory appeals in Article 62, which this court had discussion over prejudices of the parties by the extension. I think this case is unique in that it's taken this many years.
Counsel, my recollection is that there have only been a very brief period in which this case has been stayed by interlocutory appeals and all the other decisions as to whether the stay of the case have been made at the trial level, not at the appellate level.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly the Article 62, as well as other factors, but that's certainly a factor that went into it. Though it was not an appellate stay, certainly it was considered at the trial level.
Counsel, to follow up on Judge Baker's question, in terms of Hutchins and the question of whether something is highly contextual, should the judge take into account, in a case such as this, the status as a retiree and the nature of military retirement, that it's not simply an old age pension, but it is a payment for expectation of availability for continued service?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in terms of prejudice, do we measure prejudice at this stage of the proceedings? That is, if you lose here, are you at all precluded, should there be a conviction, from raising all the issues that you've raised in this case so far on appeal to show, as in Hutchins, whether there was or was not prejudice from the denial of counsel?
No, Your Honor, the issue could be raised on appeal.
Thank you.
If I may conclude, Your Honor. The appellant, this case warrants extraordinary relief because of the extraordinary nature of the case, the extraordinary nature of Lieutenant Colonel Vokey's experience in preparation on the case, and the extraordinarily improper actions of the government in severing that attorney-client relationship. The military judge below abused his discretion in finding there is an irreconcilable conflict and finding that recalled active duty would not solve that conflict. Accordingly, the only available remedy is for this court to issue the requested declaratory judgment directing that proceedings be abated until the attorney-client relationship is restored. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation. The court will be in, the case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:35 a.m.
Court stands in recess until 10:35.